We are studying a category called racial humility. The principle of racial humility is to recognize that we have no superiority because of our race, and we have no inferiority because of our race. And although in the world around us there are many people who claim a racial superiority, and many people who concede a racial inferiority, this is not bona fide from the scriptural standpoint. God looks at all members of the human race as equal. The existence of races is part of God's unique plan for the human race, and that's an entire study in and of itself. But the fact that there are different races does not indicate any equality, or rather any inequality in the particular individuals involved. All members of the human race are responsible to God based on their response to His viewpoint, His policy. And therefore, any attempt by me as a member of society to make myself or exalt myself in a superior way over another race is scripturally improper. At the same time, for me, possibly being a member of a minority race, to, through the influence of family, through the influence of society, to concede in my own soul some aspect of racial inferiority is also improper, because we are all equal in the eyes of God, and the issue is in the soul. The issue is our spiritual relationship with God. But we've established this already in previous studies, and we are now looking at some examples. The examples that we've looked at so far in connection with the racial segregation that God instructed concerning Israel. We've looked at the example of Rahab and of Ruth and a group of people called the Kenites, and we are now studying a group of people called the Gibeonites. There are many valuable principles that we can learn from them, so hopefully we can glean some of these concepts. At the present time, we are on main point 6 in the study of the Gibeonites. A little bit of background with regard to the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites are a group of people, a socio-economic group who lived, who lived in these four cities right here. Can you distinguish the brown? All right, you can see four dots there. Those are four cities, and these are the four cities of the Gibeonites. Gibeon, I can't even remember the names of them. Kiriath Jearim, Be'eroth, and then what's that last one? Keher, something, huh? What's the name of that last city? Not that it really matters what it is. What is it? Like you see, I can't even find it, just pronounce it. I'm supposed to have it in my notes, and it's here staring me in the face, and I just can't spot it. Yeah. But at any rate, there are four cities there. You have to take my word for it. And these are the four cities of the Gibeonites. They were one of the boycotted groups of people. They were made up of a group of Amorites and Amalekite. There we go. Amalekite and Amorite group of people. They were associated in these four cities, and they were boycotted by God. In other words, God had given them Israel instructions to go in and wipe these people out because of their moral depravity and because of their spiritual depravity. These people recognized the authority of Jehovah, recognized God's plan for Israel, and recognized also that God had the authority and power to destroy them. So they figured they better get on Jehovah's side. So they went to Israel in a covert way, in a deceptive way, and said, "We don't live in your land. We're from a million miles away. And we want to make a covenant with you and live with you." And Israel, or Joshua, the leader of Israel, said, "Okay, but how do we know you're not in our land?" And they said, "Well, look at us. Look at our soul, the soles of our sandals. They're worn out. Look at our clothes. They're worn out. Look at our wineskins. They've got holes in them. Look at this food, this bread. It's moldy. You know, we've been traveling a long, long time." And that was all a deception. They had prepared these things ahead of time to make it look like they had traveled a long way. Joshua, if you remember, was supposed to contact Jehovah, was supposed to go to the priest and say, "Well, is this true, Father? Are we supposed to make association with these people?" But he did not do that. Instead, he used his human viewpoint, his human logic, and he evaluated and accepted these people and made a covenant with them, said, "Yes, you can live with us." Then when they went to destroy their cities, as God had commanded, they found out, hey, these are the guys we made a covenant with. So they had a big problem, because they made a covenant in the name of Jehovah. And when you make a covenant in the name of Jehovah, you don't back out on it. So they had to allow these people to live. But this was part of God's plan to allow these people to maintain their existence in the land because they were positive to truth. They were interested in the things of God. And as a result of this, they took on a responsibility in the nation of Israel, which was a servanthood responsibility. They were instructed that they were going to be the carriers of water and the carriers of wood to the temple area or to the tabernacle area and be servants to the congregation in order to fulfill their payment, if you please, for living in the land. As a result of this, they had constant exposure to truth, constant exposure to the teachings of God's priests, and they became believers as a whole group. And not only did they just become believers, but they perpetuated this spiritual heritage on down to their children, so that many, many, many years on down the line, we are going to see that these people as a group are still very, very positive to truth and representing adequately the things of God. All right, well, that brings us then to point number six. Point number six is to make a notation that one of David's mighty men was a Gibeonite. One of David's mighty men was a Gibeonite. 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verses 1 through 4. Now these are the ones who came to David at Ziklag while he was still restricted because of Saul the son of Kish, and they were among the mighty men who helped him in war. They were equipped with bows, using both the right hand and the left to sling stones and to shoot arrows from the bow. They were Saul's kinsmen from Benjamin. The chief was Ahiezer. Then Joash, the sons of Shemaah, the Gibeathite, not Gibeonite, but Gibeathite, and Jeziel, and Peleth, the sons of Azmaveth, and Barakah, and Jehu, the Anathothite. Verse 4, and Ishmaiah, the Gibeonite, a mighty man among the 30 and over the 30. So this man had a place of responsibility among David's mighty men. He was a leader. He was not the leader. The chief is mentioned in verse 3, Ahiezer. But he is under the chief as one of a, he's a group leader over 30. That indicates he's very, very proficient in his military prowess, and he is also a man of spiritual integrity. These mighty men were not just warriors, but they were also men of spiritual integrity. They had to recognize David's authority as given to him by God to be the next king. David was a man who was operating on spiritual principles. The men associated with him needed also to adhere to those spiritual principles. Otherwise, you would have a principle of cursing through association. So we're just simply noting that this man is a Gibeonite, which means he's not a true Israelite, but he's one of the strangers, quote-unquote, living within the land, and who has adhered to the cultural principles of Israel and accepted the spiritual standards of Israel, which are Jehovah's standards. Now, that period, that brings us to about, as far as our dates go, we're talking approximately 3062 A.H. Now that's approximately, as you put a C in front of it, C means circa, and that means about. And we have the covenant made with the Gibeonites at the time of Joshua. At 2553 A.H. So you can see we're dealing with about 500 years later. You still have the Gibeonites strong, and one of them even being a mighty man. We will see this amplified in our next point. Now, for orientation, this designation A-H is Latin for A-N-O-H-O-M-I-N-U-S, Anno Hominus, which means the year of man. So the AH is the dating that I use, the dating system that I use, although I will make reference from time to time to the BC dates. The BC dates, however, are inaccurate by at least 80 years. And therefore, if I designate a BC date, it will be so by a BC and then an E on the end to indicate that this is the established or the accepted chronology according to BC. If you want an approximate BC date here, I think I have to look for it to find it. Yeah, I'd have to do some hunting for you on that one. So it's no issue, but the point I want to make anyway is not when this is taking place, but that we're dealing with about 500 years later in the history of the Gibeonites. They settled in the land of Canaan in association with Israel in 2553, and then in 3062, 500 years later, you still have them strong in the land. Now, point seven. The reason we're going through all of these points, some of them may not appear important to you at the moment, but I want a complete study of the Gibeonites so that you can be oriented to them. Point number seven, sometime during the last 10 years of Saul's reign. Somewhere between the years 3052 and 3062 AH, the last 10 years of Saul's reign. In his human viewpoint, zeal for God, he put many Gibeonites to death. Second Samuel 21:2. Now we're going to spend some time on this. First of all, some orientation. You have the man Saul. Saul is king of Israel. Saul is the first king of Israel. He was appointed king under God's approval, but with God's disapproval. How'd that sound? In other words, it was not really God's intention for Israel to have a king, but since they insisted on one, he said, okay, then you're going to have a king I'm going to choose. So he chose a king for them and allowed them to make this man his king. The problem with that is that this man did not maintain his spiritual consistency. He did not maintain his spiritual value and his dedication toward God. He got caught up with his place of responsibility. He got caught up in his kingship. He got out of fellowship with God, and he started practicing and operating totally on what we call human viewpoint. Human viewpoint is looking at things from the perspective of man rather than looking at things from the perspective of God. It's based on the principle of Isaiah 55:8-9. 55:8-9 of Isaiah says, thus says Jehovah, my ways are not your ways, neither are my thoughts your thoughts, says Jehovah. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so are my ways above your ways, and my thoughts above your thoughts. The principle in this passage is that there are two viewpoints here in the physical earth, man's viewpoint and God's viewpoint. Man does things independently of God, and this is not acceptable to God. Man tries to think that he can succeed in life. He can adjust to his fellow man. He can adjust to his universe. He can adjust to himself. And indeed, he can even adjust to God on his own terms, not using God's terms. This is human viewpoint. In other words, when we face a crisis, how we deal with that crisis is going to determine whether we are practicing human viewpoint or divine viewpoint. If we face a crisis of a of a sickness, and we fall apart and we say, oh, woe is me, what am I going to do? I can't get up, I can't eat, I can't drink, I can't go to work, I can't do this, I can't do that, oh woe is me, then we are using human viewpoint. We think that the world has ended because we are sick. In God's opinion, in God's viewpoint, since we are believers, and I'm assuming that we're using an example where someone is a believer, and in fellowship, then God has a plan for that sickness. Whatever the plan might be, we may or may not be aware of it. We may or may not be able to find out exactly why we have the particular sickness or the crisis, whatever it is. But how we look at it, we must understand the divine viewpoint of Romans 8:28. We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love him, to those who are the call, to those who are the called according to his purpose. And we then, as believers, have a special place, a unique place in the plan of God, in the family of God, and he is going to bring things into our life for our benefit. He is not going to allow anything that comes into our life that is not for our benefit. But we can practice things of our own free will that will cause harm. So if we encounter some sickness, for example, and we say, oh, woe is me, then we're not recognizing Romans 8:28. God says, this sickness is for a reason. If you stay in fellowship, if you trust me, then everything's going to work out. If you fall apart, then you're going to be miserable, and whether you get well or not, you're still going to be miserable. That's human viewpoint. Divine viewpoint means to trust God. The practice of divine viewpoint, then, is practicing what we call the faith rest experience, or the faith rest life. The faith rest life is the normal Christian way of life. This is the way we are to operate as believers in the church age, for that matter, believers of all ages have, as their standard way of life, the faith rest experience. Faith rest simply means to put total trust, total confidence in the plan and character of God based on knowledge of his word. That's very simple. Faith rest means to put total trust and total confidence in the plan and character of God in every area of life based on knowledge of his word. In other words, we cannot practice or experience faith rest unless we know something about God's word, unless we know something about his character and plan. For example, you cannot claim absolute confidence in the righteousness of God unless you know something about his righteousness. You can't claim absolute confidence in his authority, in his sovereignty, unless you know something about his authority, his sovereignty. That's why we study the Bible. That's why God has given us his revelation, his word in written form, so that we can study it, so that we can learn about him. And as we take in the word of God into our soul, this is going to stabilize us, this is going to encourage us, this is going to give us the perspective that we need in order to relate to the things around us with stability, with confidence, and experience the joy, the peace that God wants us to experience. Okay. So that's human viewpoint, and Saul gets out of fellowship shortly after he becomes king, and all he practices is human viewpoint. But he wants to please God. He wants to be acceptable to God. And so in this attempt to be acceptable to God, he analyzes his environment. He looks around, but he's using human viewpoint, not divine viewpoint, and he sees the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites, who from the time of Joshua have been responsible for carrying water, carrying wood, indeed serving the Levitical priesthood, serving the tabernacle area, these men who have been exceptional in their moral and in their spiritual endeavors, Saul looks at them and all he can see is that these are Gibeonites. These are those who are part of the boycotted races. These were supposed to be destroyed, totally destroyed by Joshua 500 years ago. How come they weren't? How come they're still living here in my land, Saul says. So Saul, in his human viewpoint zeal, thinks that he can please God by destroying these Gibeonites. Finishing the job, see? The job should have been done. These guys should have been destroyed. But see, he didn't apply divine viewpoint. If he had applied divine viewpoint, if he had studied his history, and if he had studied spiritual principles, he would have realized that God had accepted the Gibeonites. We studied last time how God accepted the Gibeonites. He approved of the covenant that Joshua made with the Gibeonites. He approved of this covenant by telling Joshua to go defend the Gibeonites. Do you remember? Shortly after the covenant was made, the other people of the land gathered together, formed an alliance, and went to attack and destroy the Gibeonites. So the leaders of the Gibeonites sent to Joshua and said, hey, we're in trouble. Joshua went to the Lord, and the Lord said, go fight for them. That indicates it was God's that God was in favor of the Gibeonites, therefore in favor of the covenant that was made. Secondly, during the actual battle, you'll have God performing supernatural activity in order to win the conflict, such as the moon, the sun standing still, or we understand the principle, the earth standing still, but from the standpoint of our eyesight, we look up, the sun isn't moving. The day was prolonged. Also the hailstones, great big huge hailstones, big as basketballs or bigger, who knows. But these great big old things landed on men and killed them right away. I mean, it didn't take any trouble at all. It just knocked somebody's head off with one of these hailstones. Well, this is supernatural activity by God. And the point that I'm making is that God approved of the covenant, approved of the association with the Gibeonites. Now, if Saul had studied and reviewed God's dealing with his people, he would have realized that the Gibeonites were accepted by God, and he had no business killing them off. So that's why, that's what he did and why he did it. Our passage, 2 Samuel 21:2, which is at page 474, if you're not there already. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. And David sought the presence of Jehovah, and Jehovah said, "It is because of Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death." Now that's the only reference we have of it. We don't have any other reference to the fact that Saul did this. But we have a reference here in verse 1 that because of this, God disciplined the land. We'll look at that in a moment. But Saul, in his zeal, put the Gibeonites to death. So that's the reference to it. Okay, now A under this. Since nothing was done about it, nothing was done about it. Saul is king. The people of the land basically are under his authority. But when he did something as ridiculous as killing off the Gibeonites, something should have been done about it. The priest should have risen up and accused Saul of his spiritual indiscretion. Something should have been done. Nothing was done about it. So God took it into his own hands. This is one of the lessons we learned. God has appointed leadership over his people. In the land of Israel, in the nation of Israel, Old Testament times, God appointed political leaders over his land, as well as spiritual leaders. In the church age, we don't have the principle of political leaders over the church. We have spiritual leaders over the church. They appear in the form of spiritual gifts. God has designated one spiritual gift per believer, and these spiritual gifts perform the leadership functions of the local church. The primary communicator of the local church is the pastor-teacher gift. The secondary communicator of the pastor, of the local church, is the exhortation gift. The third communication gift of the local church is the evangelist. And although he doesn't usually function within the local church, he has the local church as his home, and he goes out into the community and evangelizes. Usually the pastor teacher is not involved with evangelism, and usually the exhortation gift is not involved with evangelism. Doesn't mean they cannot do it. As Paul exhorted Timothy, do the work of an evangelist. And that exhortation to Timothy indicates that Timothy was not an evangelist, but he was actually a pastor teacher or possibly even an exhorter. And the instructions to him was to do the work of an evangelist. Then the next area of leadership in the local church is an administration gift. The administration gift, basically being under the authority of the communicator, is responsible for organization, keeping things running smoothly, making sure we have a cake out there to eat or to leave, making sure we have coffee to leave, making sure... I'm being sarcastic, I shouldn't. You'll have to forgive me. My wife questioned me, how come there's so much coffee left over all the time? Should we make all this coffee all the time? Oh, sure, Megan, we throw it away. We might as well have coffee for these people. If there's no coffee, then somebody's going to complain. But anyway, the administration gift is the one responsible for making sure that things run smoothly. Make sure we have lights. Make sure we have AC. Things like this. This is an administration gift. But the administration gift is not the one who actually is involved with plugging things in. You have also what is called the gift of helps or the gift of service. These are special spiritual gifts given by God so that there is unique ability to perform in these functions. Basically, with emphasis in the spiritual arena. Well, I don't want to go into details with regard to the spiritual gifts, but every believer has one, and only one gift, and that gift is his divine ability to administer in and for the church. Sometimes that gift is centered in the church, other times it goes beyond the church to the community in which the church is located. All right, back to my point. God has arranged leadership for his people. And that leadership has responsibility to carry out policy. And sometimes God just plays hand off. He says, all right, I've got a leader there. The leader's supposed to do his job. And everything's going to go fine. If the leadership does not do its job properly, then many times God has to intervene and take steps himself. This is exactly what we have in the case of King Saul. Saul violated his leadership responsibility by killing off the Gibeonites. The spiritual leaders of the land, prophets and priests, should have done something about it. They did not. Nothing was done about it, so God took it upon himself to do something about it. He disciplined the land. He brought a famine. The famine had been in the land for 3 years. That brings us then still at verse 1. The point is, since nothing was said or done, God disciplined the land. With a famine for 3 years during David's reign. Probably the beginning of David's reign, during David's reign. David reigned right after Saul. And the point is that when David took over, God allowed him opportunity to avenge, if you please, using a term that is very biblical and oftentimes very spiritual. Give David opportunity to avenge the death of the Gibeonites. David failed. David didn't do anything about it. David didn't say anything about it. So that's why God, during David's reign, see, why not during Saul's reign? God gives time for his leadership people to perform their job. And in a certain amount of time, they failed, so God picked up the stick, as it were, and said, I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to bring this to your attention and point out to you people how you have totally ignored something that is just very devastating. These people, these spiritual giants, these believers who are honoring to me, were killed and slaughtered, and you have done nothing about it. Now, from the immediate divine perspective, God is in absolute control of the death of these people. Let's not get that wrong. This is not a surprise to God. God has allowed the death of these people, and any death of a believer is nothing to be worried about or concerned about, because when a believer dies, he goes to be with the Lord. In the Old Testament period, he went to be with all other believers in a place called paradise, where there was fantastic happiness. Today, in the church age, when a believer dies, he goes immediately into the presence of God, face to face with the Lord. So if any of our loved ones dies who are believers, then we have absolutely nothing to be concerned about, nothing to be worried about, other than from the loss of fellowship with them. There is bona fide sorrow. Gee, my brother died, my sister died, my husband, my wife, my mother, my father, whatever the case might be, died, and I'm going to miss them. I'm going to miss the fellowship, the association with them. But they are a believer, and they are right now present with the Lord. They are better off than I am. They're with Jesus. I'm still here on earth in the devil's world, in the realm of darkness. They are face to face with God. And their death was not a surprise to God. Maybe it was a surprise to me. Maybe it was a shock to me. But it was not a surprise or a shock to God. Indeed, God allowed it. God permitted it. Many times God even orchestrated it. At any rate, it is in the plan of God. So with regard to the death of these Gibeonites, there is no basis for a great deal of human sorrow, because God is in control. But God still many times allows these things to take place in order to teach spiritual lessons to his people. Having foreknowledge, that is, having full awareness of everything that's going to take place in the human realm before it even takes place, he allows these things so that he can teach his people trust, teach his people faith, teach his people principles of divine viewpoint. And in the case of the Gibeonites, he allowed it for just that reason, so that the people would eventually have their focus turned to spiritual values, because the Gibeonites are going to be avenged eventually. It's going to take God's intervention to do it. All right, since nothing was said or done about it, either at the time it was done or when David, the new king, took over, he should have done something about it. He should have brought it to the surface and said, now we're going to have to take care of this thing. But he didn't. So God brings a three-year famine. That's 21, 1 through 14. Okay, but instead of reading the whole passage first, we're going to give some more points, and then we'll look at the passage. So let's go to B. David appeals to the Gibeonites for a resolve of the situation. See, here comes this famine. First year, well, no big deal, you know, famines come, famines go. Second year, boy, this thing's sure dragging out. Third year, hey God, what's going on? How come we have this famine? God said, well, you know, it's because of what Saul did. Saul destroyed the Gibeonites, and no one has done anything about it. So David said, oh, well, what should we do? Probably God said, go check with the Gibeonites. So David goes, he checks with the Gibeonites. Says, Gibeonites, what are we going to do? All your people, not all of them, but a whole bunch of your people were killed back then. What are we going to do about it? Okay, so David appeals to the Gibeonites for a resolve of the situation. And that's found in verse 3. Let's look at it. Well, let's look at verse 2. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were the sons of Israel, were not of the sons of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. Remember I told you that. And the sons of Israel made a covenant with them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. There you have the statement that I made earlier. I should have gone over to verse 2 when I mentioned that. But there you have a statement with regard to Saul's zeal. Verse 3. Thus David said to the Gibeonites, what should I do for you? And how can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance? The inheritance refers to the nation. The inheritance of Jehovah. So let's notice two things here then. One. David talks to the Gibeonites and says, what can we do to make atonement? Atonement for what? Atonement for the death of the Gibeonites. We have to do something, and he uses the term make atonement, which means, the Hebrew word looks like this, K-A-P-H-A-R, it's pronounced kafar, and it means to cover. Cover in the sense of render justice or satisfaction, provide justice or satisfaction, satisfaction, provide, to provide a justice or a satisfaction, an expression of justice or satisfaction. It says, what can we do to satisfy the blood of the Gibeonites, which is calling from the ground, as it were? An idiom used many times in the Hebrew. Remember, God used it with regard to the death of Abel. He came to Cain and said, Cain, your brother's blood is screaming to me from the ground. Well, that wasn't literally what was happening. He didn't hear this echo. Somebody killed me. Somebody killed me. It's an idiom to indicate that there has not been any justice or satisfaction for the death. All right. So, make atonement. Make a covering. And then secondly, that there might be an opportunity to bless. To bless is the next issue. Bless is the Hebrew word B-A-R-A-K, barak. We've seen this word. in the last couple of weeks quite a few times. Barak means to recognize or pronounce benefit. Recognize or pronounce benefit. Or welfare. If we are blessing God using Barak, then we are recognizing and pronouncing pronouncing that recognition of God's benefit, of God's grace. We're not wishing him to be benefited, because of course we cannot wish God to be benefited. He will be. He always will be. What we do is we recognize his benefits. We recognize his praises. But in the case of man toward man, you have the idea of promoting the welfare or promoting the benefit of an individual. So David says, look at the nation of Israel, the inheritance of Jehovah, is in trouble. We have a famine. 3 years this famine has been going on, and people are dying, people are suffering because of it. What can we do so that, and by the way, the failure to render justice because of the death of your people is the cause of this famine. So what can we do to prevent this famine from continuing? What can we do to bring about a blessing, benefit, upon the people of Israel? So those are the two issues: to kafar, to make atonement or an expression of justice, and to promote welfare. And to promote welfare, benefit. Point C, their answer reflects two things. One, it reflects their servant status. Let's make it more than two things. Secondly, it reflects their servant status. It reflects their detail of life orientation. Now, a detail of life is a pleasure of life, a possession of life. And man usually finds himself occupied with those things to the exclusion of anything else. The most important thing in my life is details, money, food. Most important thing is food. Obviously we need food, and perhaps we need money. At any rate, it's not to be the most important thing. But you live for food, you live for money, you live for drink, you live for clothes, you live for your car, you live for status symbols, you live for friends. Everything, the most important thing in your life is to have friends, to have loved ones. Most important thing in your life. See, these are details of life. And we could go on and give a big old long list of details of life. And some of them are necessary, some of them are not necessary. But God is the one who is responsible for the details of life. Some that are necessary are, for example, food, shelter, clothing. Okay? Food, shelter, and clothing. Those are necessary for physical life. Details of life relate to physical existence. Necessary for physical existence, food, shelter, clothing. Not necessary for physical life. Friends. Surplus money. And actually, let's put it this way. Money isn't necessary. Food, shelter, clothing is necessary. And depending on which society you live in, money is only necessary as it provides food, shelter, and clothing, right? So the point is, money is not necessary. Food is necessary. So if you were to go to work every day and get paid food, you wouldn't need money. So the point is that the detail of life that is necessary is food. Money is not necessary. Money usually represents a surplus. All right, friends, money, status symbols. Who's got the biggest car? Who's got the most cars? Who's got the biggest television set? Et cetera, et cetera. Sex is a detail of life, unnecessary detail of life. Many people are totally occupied with sex. And we could make this list, though, very, very lengthy, and I don't want to take the time to do it, but you have a great deal of things. Authority is a detail of life. You know, having authority in your community, being in a place of prestige, thinking that you're somebody, and having, depending upon that, having to be the number one at all times. Well, these are details of life that are not necessary. All right, well, we're going to see then that their answer reflects details of life, orientation, and three, it's going to reflect their spiritual values. Their spiritual values. Or we can call it dedication to God. Spiritual value refers to dedication to God. And so their answer is going to reflect all these things. And so we will look at it in verses 4 through 6. Oh, let's put... Well, how do I want to do this? I'll leave it at that three, but there's going to be amplification. So let's look at verse 4. Then the Gibeonites said to him, "We have no concern of silver or with gold." We're not concerned with money. In other words, this represents the surplus details of life. We're not concerned with getting a whole bunch of money. You know, you can't pay us for this thing. Now, this also reflects something about their original purpose in the land of Israel. They were designated to be servants. They were cursed, if you please, with a servant status, and they were not authorized to practice free enterprise endeavors. They were to be servants in the land without the privilege of free enterprise activities. They could not have their own business. And they have maintained that perspective 500 years later. All right, we're not interested in silver or gold, and we're not really interested in Saul or his house. You know what that is? Revenge. We don't want revenge. We're not interested in getting back at Saul or his house. Then they make reference to the normal thing that should happen. Nor is it for us to put any man to death. It's not our responsibility to put people to death. Maybe that's what they deserve from the standpoint of morality. Maybe even from the standpoint of God's law, that's what they deserve. Saul's already dead, however, so it's not going to really help to put Saul to death. I mean, you can't. So what they're saying, but there's somebody else involved in that Saul's house, which we'll look at in a moment. But they're saying is it's not within our power to put somebody to death. Don't give us any responsibility like us. Don't tell us what to do. Don't come to me, David, and say, "All right, it's in your hands. Do whatever you want." So they turn it around because they're in a servant status and because they are totally dedicated to God. They're using divine viewpoint. They say it's in God's hands. So they turn around and say, "David, you do what's necessary. You do what you think's best." End of verse 4. "I will do..." Or rather, I'm sorry, he said to them, and he said, "I will do for you whatever you say." So then they consult together and they say, "Okay, David, if you are going to put this into our hands after all, we are going to suggest what is the best thing to do, but we are going to apply divine viewpoint. We are going to use God's standards." Verse 5. So they said to the king, "The man who consumed us, and who planned to exterminate us from remaining within the border of Israel, let 7 men from his sons be given to us, and we will hang them," look at this next phrase, "we will hang them before Jehovah," before the Lord. That indicates their total dedication to God. They're saying this is going to be done in the eyes of God. This is going to be done according to spiritual standards. In Gibeah of Saul, in their hometown, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, "I will give them." All right, so what we have represented here is point, let's make this, all right, let's make it A again, A under 3. Now, if I leave my outline, I've got to make up outlines, and that's what I've done. I already left my own outline. A, they have no concern for details. This is a little bit of repetition, but no concern for details or personal revenge. But express humility, true humility, Their true humility is expressed in saying, we don't care about silver or gold, we don't care about Saul and his house. You do what you want. David turned around and said, no, you decide what is best. So they say, okay, if you want us to determine what is just and what is right, then Saul's house should pay. And seven sons is a good number. Why? Seven is the number of completion. Seven represents a total offering, a total sacrifice, a total vindication of justice. There's also going to be another factor that it needs to be considered with regard to these seven of the sons of Saul, which we'll look at in a moment. Point B. No attitude of mental antagonism. No grudge, etc. No revenge, no... In other words, they don't hold a grudge. They're not... David doesn't... David shows up and they don't say, well, it's about time, we've been waiting for this. Now, here's what we want you to do. 70 of these guys. No, they have no mental attitude. They're not out of fellowship. All right, point C. They suggest a punishment and leave the verdict to God. They suggest the punishment, and leave the rest to David. Leave the rest to David. D, the execution. And that's what it is. It is an execution based on both moral and spiritual standards. The execution of seven sons is based on verse 1. The phrase, and his bloody house. It says, why is the famine in the land? And this is God speaking in verse 1. Because of Saul and because of his bloody house. That tells us that not Saul is not the one who necessarily picked up the sword and killed these Gibeonites. But Saul had it done by members of his own household. Now we don't know who was involved. But we have to understand the justice of God, and this is a principle that we have to learn from many, many passages. God's justice is always perfectly fair. God does not execute or judge the innocent unless he has good reason to do so. In this case, the seven sons being executed probably had a part in the execution of the Gibeonites. This is not, this accounting is not that far down the line from the actual event. We're talking about a 10-year period. And even though these appear to be grandsons, as you notice in verse 6, let seven men from his sons, see, so they appear to be grandsons. You can have a lot of grandsons of the proper age to have taken part in this slaughter and therefore be held entirely responsible. So the execution of the seven sons is based on verse 1, Saul and his bloody house. They all had part of it. They all had something to do with it. All right, our last point under this. The punishment was recognized. The punishment was recognized. As divinely sanctioned. Based on two things. The punishment was recognized as divinely sanctioned based on two things. In other words, God approved of it. Verse 6 and 9. Let's put it here at point 1 again. Verse 6 and 9. The phrase, before Jehovah. By the way, every time you see the word Lord in all capital letters in the Old Testament, it refers to the personal name of God, which is Jehovah. And we shouldn't say the Jehovah, we should say Jehovah. There's no definite article in the Hebrew. Verse 6 says, we will hang them before Jehovah. Verse 9, then he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the mountain before Jehovah. So 6 and 9 uses that term twice. Before Jehovah is an idiom to indicate, according to divine standards, in the presence of God. All right, secondly, verse 14. God was moved as a result of this sacrifice. And they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan his son in the country of Benjamin and Zelah in the grave of Kish his father. Thus they did all that the king commanded, and after that, now this is referring to all the other bones, we should have started at verse 13. Let's look at verse 13. And he brought up the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from there, and they gathered the bones of those who had been hanged. And then they buried them all together. End of verse 14. God was moved by entreaty for the land. In other words, God approved of this. All right, now this word God was moved by entreaty is the Hebrew word A-T-H-A-R, pronounced athar. And it is a niphal, imperfect, in the Hebrew, which indicates the reality of God's response toward this sacrifice. The principle of moved by entreaty indicates that God, let's put it this way, the prayer was effective because they met certain requirements laid down by God. Certain requirements laid down by God. The prayer was effective because they met certain requirements laid down by God. The requirements that were met were the spiritual principles of morality, justice. All right, now let's read through our passage here very quickly. verse 9. Then he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the mountain before the Lord. So that the seven of them fell together, and they were put to death in the first days of harvest at the beginning of barley harvest. And Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread for herself on the rock from the beginning of harvest until it rained on them from the sky. And she allowed neither the birds of the sky to rest on them by day nor the beasts of the field by night. This is one of the relatives. When it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, then David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from the men of Jabesh Gilead, who had stolen them from the open square of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines struck down Saul in Gilboa. And he brought up the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan the son from there, and they gathered the bones of those who had been hanged. They buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan his son in the country of Benjamin in Zelah, in the grave of Kish his father. Thus they did all that the king commanded, and after that God was moved by entreaty for the land. All right, there you have then the whole passage with regard to the expression of justice upon the descendants of Saul because of their attack of the Gibeonites. So, in other words, this is just another expression of God honoring the covenant he made with them a long time ago. He still honors that covenant. I was going to holler at you in one more minute. The covenant that he made with Joshua, that Joshua made with the Gibeonites. We saw that verified during the war of Gibeon, or at Gibeon, and then we see it again verified here 500 years later by God saying, hey, I want something done about this. And when something that was done about it, God was moved by entreaty for the land. In other words, the famine was removed, and rain came, and you had the discipline removed from the land. Okay, well, as far as our study of the Gibeonites, I have 3 points left, and we really can't cover them today. We don't have time, so tomorrow we'll pick up at point 8 and deal further with the Gibeonites. What happened at the Babylonian captivity with the Gibeonites? What happened after the Babylonian captivity with the Gibeonites? And let me assure you that the Gibeonites went into captivity with Israel to Babylon, and when they returned 70 years later, guess who came back with them? The Gibeonites, and guess who picked up right where they left off? Serving in the tabernacle and temple area. The Gibeonites. So we'll see, starting tomorrow, we'll pick up, finish that, and move on in our study of racial humility. A few more points left, and our next, as soon as we finish up with racial humility, our next category will be gender humility. How do we view our gender? That's already off. How do we view the fact that we're male? How do we view the fact that we're female? What does God's Word have to say about it? Am I superior because I'm male? Are you ladies inferior because you're female? Or vice versa? Oh, okay.